The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome, everyone, to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling something huge, a question that honestly probably keeps a lot of us up at night sometimes. Are the greats, you know, the world-class performers, are they just born that way? Or is it something else?
Yeah, and we're going to explore that using PEAK, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. It's a really fascinating book.
Because it's not just theory, right? It's based on decades of scientific research.
Precisely. And our goal today is to unpack that science and maybe, just maybe, give you a practical roadmap to getting much, much better at basically anything you care about.
A roadmap that suggests maybe that whole idea of innate talent is, well, maybe it's a bit of a myth we tell ourselves.
That's the core argument, yeah.
Yeah.
That it might be more of a comfortable excuse than a biological reality for most limitations.
Okay, I'm hooked already. We all know someone like that, don't we? The person who just seems naturally good at something. Effortless.
The natural musician, the gifted coder.
Exactly. This book kind of pulls back the curtain on that. So where do we start? Let's talk about the main guy behind this research.
Right. The central figure is Anders Ericsson. He was a Swedish psychologist, professor at Florida State University. And he wasn't just commenting on expertise. He spent his entire career studying it, like really systematically.
Doing experiments, not just observing.
Yeah, controlled experiments with chess grandmasters, violin virtuosos, elite athletes, surgeons, you name it. He was trying to figure out the actual mechanisms.
Now, people might know his name from that famous 10,000-hour rule. That came from his work, didn't it?
It did, specifically a 1993 study on violinists. But, and this is really important, Ericsson co-wrote PEAK, partly to correct how that rule got, well, misunderstood.
Misunderstood how?
Well, everyone latched on to the number 10,000 hours, like it was some magic threshold. Put in the time, become an expert.
Yeah, I've heard it used like that.
But Ericsson had to step in and say, hold on, that's missing the point. His research showed it's not just the volume of hours, it's the quality and the method used during those hours. That's the critical part.
So you could practice poorly for 10,000 hours and still be pretty average.
Exactly. You could even get worse. The how is everything. And that distinction really drives the whole book.
Okay, so the book is kind of two things at once. It lays out the science, but it's also a practical guide.
Yeah, it's like, here's the proof that human potential and adaptability are way bigger than we usually assume. And here's how you can actually tap into that, whether you're learning guitar, trying to be a better manager, or helping your kids learn.
It really aims to dismantle that comforting idea of natural ability, doesn't it?
Systematically. It replaces it with evidence for structured, effortful training. When Ericsson talks about world-class performance, he's digging into the specific mental structures, the cognitive advantages, and even the physical changes that separate the best from the rest.
And it applies everywhere, not just music or chess.
That's what's so powerful. He shows the underlying principles are the same, whether you're looking at memory champions, elite surgeons, or top athletes. The brain learns and adapts using the same fundamental mechanisms.
All right, let's get into those mechanisms. Where's a good place to start? That story about the student. Falloon.
Ah, yes, Steve Falloon. A classic study. He was just a regular undergrad student at Carnegie Mellon. Started the experiment with a totally normal short-term memory for digits.
Like he could remember about seven numbers in a row.
Exactly. The standard seven plus or minus two. That's typical. But then Ericsson and his team trained him using specific techniques, not for years, but over like weeks of focus practice sessions.
And what happened?
Get this. He went from remembering seven digits to 82.
82. Seriously.
82 random digits. It's incredible. And Falloon wasn't special. He was just a normal student subjected to a very specific, structured training method focused on building mnemonic strategies.
Wow. Okay. So that right there blows up the idea of fixed limits for something like memory.
It really does. It shows that what we perceive as an innate limit might just be a boundary we haven't pushed against with the right kind of effort.
So if we can't all immediately jump into the super intense training of grandmasters, what's the starting point?
The starting point is what Ericsson calls purposeful practice. This is something anyone can start doing.
Okay, what makes practice purposeful?
It needs four things. One, specific well-defined goals for the session. Not just get better, but improve this specific aspect. Two, intense focus, no distractions. Three, feedback. You need to know immediately if you're doing it right or wrong.
And the fourth.
And this is key, constantly pushing slightly outside your comfort zone. You have to be stretching, reaching a bit beyond what you can currently do easily. Just repeating what you already know isn't purposeful practice.
Right. That makes sense. I think a lot of us just go through the motions sometimes. We put in the hours at work or practicing a hobby, but we're comfortable.
Exactly. And if you're comfortable, you're probably not improving much. You're performing, not practicing purposefully.
And this connects to how our brains actually work.
Absolutely. This effortful practice ties directly into neuroplasticity, which is just the brain's amazing ability to change itself, to physically reorganize its structure and connections in response to what we demand of it.
It's not fixed hardware, then.
Not at all. It's constantly adapting. Think about the London taxi drivers.
Oh, yeah. The ones who have to memorize the knowledge, that incredibly complex map of London streets.
Right. Thousands of streets, landmarks. It's a massive memory task. And studies using brain scans found something remarkable.
What was that?
The part of their brain heavily involved in spatial memory, the posterior hippocampus, was physically larger in experienced taxi drivers compared to control groups.
So their brains literally changed shape to accommodate the skill.
Pretty much. Their brains adapted structurally to meet the demands of the task. You train hard in a specific way, your brain physically remodels itself to support that skill.
That's wild. Okay, so practice changes the brain physically, but what about cognitively? You mentioned mental representations earlier. What are those?
Yes. This is probably the crucial concept. Mental representations are these highly complex, sophisticated internal structure or patterns that experts develop in their long-term memory.
Like internal maps.
Kinda, yeah. Mm-hmm. But much more intricate. They allow experts to process information in their field incredibly efficiently, to see patterns novices miss, to predict outcomes, and to plan effectively.
So back to chess. A beginner sees pieces.
But a grandmaster sees relationships, threats, potential futures, historical parallels, all organized into meaningful chunks because they've built these incredibly rich mental representations over thousands of hours of practice. They're not just calculating faster, they're perceiving the game on a whole different level.
Okay, I think I get it. The real goal of practice isn't just to do the thing better, it's to build better mental software for doing the thing.
That's a great way to put it. Better mental representations lead to better performance, better decisions, better anticipation.
So purposeful practice is the foundation. But then Erickson talks about the gold standard, right? Deliberate practice. How is that different? It sounds even more intense.
It is. Deliberate practice is purposeful practice, but with much stricter conditions. It's really the engine that drives people to the absolute top of their fields.
What are those conditions?
Okay, three main things distinguish it. First, like purposeful practice, it absolutely requires sustained effort outside your comfort zone. It needs to be mentally and sometimes physically taxing.
Which is hard. That's probably where most people drop off.
It requires real commitment, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Second, deliberate practice generally requires a skilled teacher or coach.
Why is the coach so essential here?
Because as you get better, it becomes harder to identify your own weaknesses. A good coach can pinpoint exactly what you need to work on and design specific exercises or tasks to target those weaknesses. They provide that crucial external perspective.
That makes sense. We tend to practice what we like, what we're good at. The coach makes you confront the difficult parts.
Exactly. And third, deliberate practice involves immediate, specific, and actionable feedback. You try something. The coach tells you precisely what went right and wrong. You adjust. You try again. It's a tight feedback loop focused purely on improvement, not just performance.
Okay, so it's really structured, really focused, often guided, and definitely not just about racking up hours.
Not at all. It's about highly focused, high effort, feedback-driven improvement on specific weaknesses identified by an expert.
So zooming out a bit, what are the really big takeaways or themes that you think listeners should grasp from this?
Well, the first big one is understanding the plateau problem. Most people improve at something for a while, then they hit a wall and just stop getting better.
Yeah, that happens all the time. Why?
Erickson argues it's usually because their practice becomes automatic and comfortable. They reach a kind of equilibrium he calls it homeostasis. They're performing acceptably, so the push to improve stops. That comfort zone becomes a rut.
So breaking a plateau means intentionally seeking out that discomfort again, designing challenges.
Precisely. You have to actively identify why you've plateaued and then design practice that forces you to struggle with that specific limitation. It reframes getting stuck not as a lack of talent, but often as a lack of the right kind of challenging practice.
Which ties into the next big theme, I guess. Really demolishing the talent myth.
Definitely. The book argues compellingly that what we often call innate talent is more likely the result of accumulated advantages, like starting early, having great teachers, and, crucially, engaging in more effective practice methods for longer.
Like the Polgar sisters in chess.
Exactly. Their father explicitly set out to prove that genius could be made, not just born. He provided an incredibly intense, focused, and supportive chess environment from a very young age. And, well, all three became chess masters, two of them grandmasters. Their talent was demonstrably built.
Knowing that feels, well, it feels empowering, actually. Like maybe the ceiling is higher than we thought.
It suggests the potential is there if we use the right methods.
Yeah.
And that connects to the third theme. The goal is mental change.
Right. Building those mental representations we talked about.
Yeah. The ultimate point of all this effortful practice isn't just to execute a skill better in the moment. It's to fundamentally change your brain, to build those superior mental maps that allow for better perception, faster understanding, and more insightful decision-making within your field. That's the long-term payoff.
The book has some really memorable lines that capture these ideas, too. We should probably share a few.
Yeah, there are some great quotes. One that really hits home, reframes why people don't achieve extraordinary things.
Is it this one? The reason that most people don't possess these extraordinary physical capabilities isn't because they don't have the capacity for them, but rather because they're satisfied to live in the comfortable rut of homeostasis and never do the work that is required to get out of it.
That's the one. It basically says the potential is often there, but the will to leave the comfort zone isn't. It puts the responsibility back on us.
Ouch, but true. And then there's the one about practice versus performance.
Oh, yeah. If you are not pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone, you are not improving. You are just performing.
That's a sharp distinction, like playing the same song, you know, perfectly over and over. That's performance, not practice for improvement.
Exactly. Improvement requires that element of struggle, of pushing the boundary.
And because pushing that boundary is hard, and we often can't see our own flaws, there's the quote about needing help.
Right. The best way to get past any barrier is to come at it from a different direction, which is one reason why it is useful to work with a teacher or coach.
It highlights that getting really good usually isn't a solo journey. You need that outside eye.
Absolutely. That external feedback and guidance is critical for deliberate practice.
Okay, this is all fascinating science, but how do people actually use this? Let's say for professionals, people in their careers.
Okay, huge implications here. The main thing is shifting away from just relying on learning by doing or experience. You need to adopt a specific practice mindset.
What does that look like for, say, a manager? They can't practice managing like a violinist practices scales.
True, but they can adapt the principles. First, identify key challenging skills. Maybe it's handling difficult conversations or strategic planning or negotiating under pressure.
Okay.
Then, instead of just waiting for those situations to happen, create specific practice scenarios. Maybe role play a tough negotiation with a colleague, instructing them beforehand on how to push back, or simulate a crisis meeting.
And the key is getting immediate, detailed feedback afterwards.
Exactly. Ask that colleague, what worked, what didn't? Where did my argument fall apart? How was my tone? You need specific, actionable feedback, not just good job. It's about breaking down complex skills into components you can practice deliberately in low-stakes settings.
That's way different from just passively accumulating years of experience.
Totally different. It's intentional, structured improvement versus just showing up.
And what about students or anyone learning something new on their own?
Similar principles. Ditch passive rereading. Focus on active recall testing yourself constantly. Identify your specific weak spots, the concepts you keep missing, the techniques you fumble, and spend disproportionate practice time only on those areas.
There's a great historical example of this, isn't there? Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, Franklin wanted to improve his writing. He didn't just read good essays, he actively practiced.
How did he do it?
He'd read an essay from a publication called The Spectator, jot down notes on the main points, wait a bit, then try to rewrite the essay himself from his notes.
Okay.
Then, and this is the deliberate practice part, he would meticulously compare his version to the original, analyzing differences in structure, word choice, clarity, and flow. The original essay served as his expert coach, providing the feedback.
That's brilliant. He created his own feedback loop.
Exactly. It's a perfect example of self-guided, deliberate practice.
You know, the thing that really surprised me reading about this was the whole Mozart story. We always hear about him as this ultimate example of innate genius, composing symphonies practically as a toddler.
Right. The myth is powerful.
But Erickson points out that Mozart's father was an accomplished music teacher who started training him incredibly intensely from a very, very young age. His earliest compositions. Apparently, they were heavily corrected and guided by his dad.
Yeah, it wasn't magic. It was arguably one of the earliest and most intense examples of deliberate practice we know of. Just starting extremely young with expert guidance. It doesn't diminish Mozart's greatness, but it reframes how he achieved it.
It really does. It makes it less about divine spark and more about process. The big lesson for me is just how adaptable we potentially are, but that potential is only really unlocked through this very specific kind of intelligent, focused, effortful practice.
Couldn't agree more. And I think the ultimate message is actually quite hopeful. It sort of democratizes excellence. It's that the pathway used by the world's best isn't necessarily a super genetic code. It's a process, a repeatable methodology.
A process that's available to anyone willing to put in the right kind of work.
Exactly. Which leads us to a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on this week.
Okay, let's hear it.
Considering these principles, the need for discomfort, focused effort, feedback, what's one skill or area in your life that you've maybe mentally filed away as, I'm just not good at that, or that's beyond me? Could you, this week, identify one small aspect of that skill, step just outside your comfort zone, and design even a tiny focused practice session for it? What would it look like to intentionally seek out that uncomfortable edge just for a little while?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great challenge. Go find the discomfort.
Go find the discomfort. That's where the growth happens.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.